Hello, everyone. I'm just going to say a few words to introduce Pat Gaffney, who is the General Secretary of the British section of Pax Christi. Pax Christi, I now realise, was founded in 1945 in France, and it was founded as a means towards Franco-German reconciliation after the war. It spread at first in Europe, but quite quickly it was recognised in 1952 as the international Catholic peace movement. The Pax Christi network now has 115 member organisations and works in more than 50 countries. Its UK roots go back to the late 50s, and by 1961 it got round to appointing its first chaplain, whose name I think will mean something to some of you. It was Bruce Kent, then a young curate, and I did find by looking him up that he spoke here, he got in ahead of you, November 2007. Pat has been General Secretary of the British section since 1990. And now we will get on with her talk, but introduce it with our usual series prayer. Let us pray. God, our refuge and strength, bring near the day when wars shall cease and poverty and pain shall end, that earth may know the peace of heaven, through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Thank you. It's good to be here. I have a bit of a cold, so I may be a bit croaky, so I hope my voice will hold and carry. Remembrance this year is rightly being marked with the depth and creativity that the centenary demands. Art installations, the ringing of bells, beacons being lit for prayer for peace, stories being retold. And each one of us will have our own story of war and how it's remembered. So let me start with a few of my own personal reflections. As a child, I probably heard more about the Easter Rising of 1916 than of the First World War. That was part of my culture, being brought up in an Irish, Scottish, Catholic family, with another sometimes romanticised, sentimentalised view of that time. Over the years, I've visited many sites of violence and memorials to those who've died in violence and war. I remember visiting the Santa Cruz Cemetery in Dili in East Timor, where in 1991, 250 people were gunned down by Indonesian troops, supported with British arms sales, as they gathered to commemorate friends who had been killed in earlier protests. Their story is remembered in simple murals painted on the walls of the cemetery that have become a focus for human rights activity for many years. Then I visited the marketplace in Sarajevo, where in 1994, a bomb killed 69 people and wounded more than 200. Those in the city were literally sitting targets for the snipers in the surrounding hills. Today, people come to buy and sell fruit and bread and vegetables, overlooked by a giant red glass wall with the names of those who were killed. A fragile piece is holding there, with ordinary people making gestures towards one another in a spirit of healing and reconciliation. And I remember on one occasion, with an international group from Pax Christi, we took part in a peace pilgrimage to the Commonwealth, French and German cemeteries in Flanders. But it was the German cemetery in Vladslo that touched us most. built only in 1956. It has the moving statue, The Grieving Parents, by the noted German sculptress Kathy Kollwitz. They hug themselves. The mother is bent over as if she's been winded by the wounds and the news of her son's death. There are no serried ranks of tombstones, simply slabs that are embedded in the grass, bearing the names of the 25,000 soldiers whose remains are buried there. In our group were people from Rwanda, Sudan, Colombia, Sri Lanka, and beyond, where the killing fields remain and the memorials are yet to be created. But almost as one voice, we prayed that our leaders, our world leaders, would make their own peace pilgrimages to the killing fields of the world, to see and to feel and to remember the havoc and devastation of war. For me, remembrance of war calls me to the task of peacemaking. But I'm aware that much of our remembering, as I mentioned right at the beginning, is determined from where we come from, where we stand or where we sit. So perhaps it's always useful to ask ourselves, who remembers what and why? Is our remembrance inclusive or exclusive? Do we remember just our own or all those whose lives have been destroyed by war? Does our remembrance move us beyond sentimental indulgence to a firm resolve to do all we can to ensure that the causes of war and conflict are addressed and that resources are freed and made available to develop the tools and skills needed to support non-violent approaches and alternatives? For much of the past 30 years, as you heard in the introduction, my worldview has been very shaped by my work with Pax Christi, the Peace of Christ. And you heard that the movement began in France. A French bishop, Bishop Theas, spoke in his cathedral against the deportation and persecution of Jews. He was arrested by the Gestapo and sent to a detention camp where most prisoners were transported to concentration camps in Germany. He was imprisoned with Protestants, Jews, non-believers, trade unionists, young resistance officers, and so on. When some prisoners asked for a day retreat, he preached about forgiveness and suggested that they should pray for their captors. This provoked outrage, as you can imagine, given that context. But he replied to them, "My friends, I cannot proclaim anything except what the Lord has said. Love your enemies, no more and no less." And at the same time, in another part of France, Martha Dortel Claudeau, a teacher, was concerned about the practical and the spiritual divisions that had been created between the peoples of France and Germany. She wanted to make a gesture of reconciliation, and she invited people in her town to join her in praying for the spiritual and practical healing between French and German people. She wrote in her journal at that time, "Jesus died for everyone. No one should be excluded from one's prayer." She approached the bishop with her ideas, and he warmed to them and agreed to give her his support, and so the movement Pax Christi was born. In their remembrance of war, they were drawn back to the gospel. Evil cannot be overcome with evil. Evil can only be overcome with love. They knew that Christians had failed and needed to repent, to change, to commit to a future without hatred and war, to build bridges of reconciliation and institutions that would ensure the peace of Europe. And how tragic the whole Brexit story is drawing us away from that. The movement grew first in France and Germany, and the early symbols were created and used as gestures of remembrance and reconciliation. Recognizing the difficulty of dialogue so soon after the pain of war, some former German soldiers who were drawn to Pax Christi felt that they needed to express their need of healing and forgiveness. And on Good Friday in 1947, they took a cross made of wood and steel, 3 meters high, weighing 150 kilograms. They carried it from church to church, village to village in their home diocese. And in the middle of the cross was a carving of the suffering face of Jesus, hope of forgiveness to those who do penance. In the early 50s, the cross was taken to other countries in Europe and eventually to Rome to show that they did not want war in their lives or the lives of others, but were working for peace. And Pope Pius XII blessed them and their cross, saying that the cross should be carried wherever peace was in danger. So that germ of an idea by one woman, supported by her bishop, has grown into an international movement that you heard of, with members in 50 countries around the world, Christians and now peoples of other faith, working to challenge violence in its many forms and create just and sustainable peace. But sadly, the needs are perhaps greater today, where too often a false peace is being offered to people, echoing the words of the prophet Jeremiah. They've healed the wounds of my people lightly. They say peace, peace, when there is no peace. So what of our world at war today, 100 years on? The wars of our time destroy civilian communities and lead to the forcible displacement of millions, more than at any other time. The UNHCR report that around 65 million people are displaced by war and conflict today. And just in the past 7 years, 5.5 people have fled the war in Syria. Million people have fled the war in Syria. We're also living now in the 18th year of the so-called War on Terror. Disastrous wars have been fought by the US and her allies in Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Syria, and so on. We've seen the use of torture, extraordinary rendition, extrajudicial killings as an integral part of the military toolbox, with an increased use of armed drones in what we call targeted signature killings, and now in our own environment, the creation of hostile environments that I think end up pushing people further underground. All of this, I believe, has done more to create suspicion and, in some cases, bitter insurgencies that draw in younger generations. The problem of terror hasn't gone away, and yet the military response still dominates. And in his analysis of this 18-year war, Paul Rogers, professor of peace studies at Bradford, writes that further military engagements of this kind won't be any the less counterproductive. They are, he says, born of an outlook that appears to have little or no understanding of the sustained impact of Western military intervention. Being locked into this single-minded approach means that we fail to see the real security threats of our time. Poverty within and between countries. The impact of climate change on the earth and the ways it contributes to mass migration. The use of violence to control access to resources. And fear used as a means of controlling people. As Christians, I believe we should be troubled by the relative ease with which we as a country have been taken to war. Mrs. Thatcher and the Falklands, Mr. Blair and Iraq, Mr. Cameron, Libya, Mrs. May and previous leaders, the Middle East. How sad it is. How sad it is that leadership is so often associated with toughness and that egos and status are boosted by a willingness to take a country to war. Such toughness, displayed by other world leaders too, I think is a dangerous quality because of the damaging consequence it brings to the lives of millions. So what are some of the features of this model for us? Let's begin with the money and the unchallenged military spending. Globally, the world's spending over $1.6 billion a year on war. Our own national budget stands at $48 billion, way in excess of what we spend on overseas aid and on environmental programs. In a time of austerity such as we face now, military budgets are rarely challenged, and at election time, it seemed to be a virtue to big up our military role in the world. We invest in vanity projects, like the £200 million spent on closing down the Axe Nimrod spy plane project. We have a government willing to spend $250 billion on Trident, a massively expensive and I would say immoral insurance policy that many, even in the military, are challenging today. Meanwhile, thousands rely on food banks, homelessness is growing, and we're told we cannot afford to take in refugees from countries at war. We live in a war economy. Peace agreements are bad news for the military industry. We are one of the largest military exporters in the world, and the arms trade here is both protected and a priority trade. We engage our royal family and top politicians in promoting arms sales. Following a visit of Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salem in the spring, Defence Minister Gavin Williamson secured a new £5 billion deal for the UK to co-invest in developing a new generation of fighter jets and drones. Alistair Burt, speaking just a couple of months ago, said, "There is no political justification from withdrawing arms to Saudi Arabia." Arms that are being used by the coalition in Yemen. And you'll all know that Lisa Grand, the UN's Agency for Humanitarian Coordination, has warned us that if this war continues, it's likely that 12 or 13 million civilians will be at risk of starvation in Yemen. How do we imagine such actions are perceived in the countries on the front lines of such violence? I think they probably convey a message that profits and maintaining our military power rule over lives lost, over the displacement of people and the marginalisation of those who are already vulnerable. I think they convey a message that we lack the will and imagination to use the skills, resources, people power, knowledge to bring non-violent peacemaking processes to situations of injustice, to heal the wounds of the people and the planet. So what do we need to do? How do we resolve to do better? How do we not allow situations in the world to continue where the assumption is that there, if there's a problem, the answer is to drop more bombs? And this, of course, is our work in Pax Christi and the work of the wider peace movement today. And our resolve and determination has been re-energized through a joint project that we have helped to create with the Vatican, the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative. In his work, Pope Francis is a great ally. His voice and message speaks to all faiths and none. When our project was launched in 2016, Pope Francis described the time that we're living at as an era of rolling war, a time of world war by installments. He never minces his words or shuns controversy. And in his speech to the US Congress in 2015, he said, "Why are deadly weapons being sold to those who inflict untold suffering on individuals and society?" Sadly, the answer we all know is simply for money. Money that is drenched in blood, innocent blood. His message to us in 2016 was clear. He invited us in Pax Christi to revitalise the tools of non-violence and active non-violence in particular. And since then, we, practitioners, theologians, academics, religious and lay people from a rich and diverse group of people around the globe, have been working together to move our church and our society to a closer commitment to gospel non-violence. At the heart of this work are the efforts and achievements of individuals and organisations whose faith and courage push back against the culture of war and violence, who've chosen different ways. Those who use diplomacy, advocacy programmes to uphold international law, education, those who enable communities to prevent conflict from erupting into violence. There is a very powerful non-violent toolbox that contains hundreds of techniques, from Jesus to Gandhi to Martin Luther King. Around the globe, individuals are inspired to say no. They challenge violence through mediation, non-cooperation, protest, direct action. I think of those involved in unarmed civilian protection, a model that's gaining credibility. You're probably aware of the Ecumenical Accompaniment Programme in Israel and Palestine, or Christian peacemaker teams, people working in the Middle East and Colombia and Afghanistan, trained volunteers who live and work with communities, whose role is to diffuse violent situations and encourage people to see one another as human beings and hold authorities to account. Then there's the public, painstaking work of community peacemakers. And I think of the Christian and Muslim women in Liberia who were so tired of the violence and the lack of good political leadership. They organised, they fasted, they prayed, they held sit-ins until they forced the president to meet with them and began on a pathway of an effective change, which led to their first woman leader. And just in these recent days, I'm thinking of the young people in Afghanistan, Afghan peace volunteers, the People's Peace Movement, who have been bravely preparing for the elections, who know that it's through education, the development of freedom of the press, building a new civil society, that they can challenge the fear and the violence that tries to stifle peace in that region. And we hear of the role of the need to heal memories, from Northern Ireland to Colombia to Bosnia. Those who know that trauma, fear, anger, and revenge are the roots of future violence. So a colleague from Northern Ireland speaks of the need for work for a shared understanding of what has gone before. After all, she says, is it not necessary to try and understand? It's not necessary to understand another person's point of view, but to try at least to listen and to stand in their shoes. And this might lead the way to genuine dialogue and make bridge building more possible. And there are those who work with young people on the ever-growing knife and gun crime in our society. One of our members in London is involved in such a project, and she says that the biggest challenge in our society is how we give young people a positive sense of identity, a way of enjoying activities so they're not drawn into the destruction of gangs and the culture that gangs represent. And her parish, in cooperation with the local community, police and schools, is involved and is going to host a knife and gun collection scheme. The church is a focal point and it displays outside a big banner, "Choose life, not the knife." And they're aware that there's a much bigger problem to be addressed, but they hope that in taking this initiative, they'll open the door to discussion and help the community reflect on the direction it needs to take. All of these non-violent actions bring the concerns of violence and their causes to the forefront. They empower others to come on board and create a moral crisis, which they should do, for our governments and community leaders, for our military and the multinationals who benefit from war. They make local and global connections, reminding us of our common struggle, no matter where it happens to take place. They create acts of solidarity with communities beyond our own borders. However, the language and actions of peacemaking are not always easy to convey and are sometimes deliberately misrepresented, especially in times of remembrance. They demand an honesty and a clarity and a dialogue. So we don't simply say, no more war. We bring to the table a much larger toolbox of approaches and the experience of thousands of peacemakers around the world working to prevent injustice and structural violence, working to dismantle the tools of war, offer civilian protection, peacebuilding, education, and to skill people in the transformation needed to create just peace rather than just war approaches to injustice and conflict. Jesus, through his words and actions, inspired Gandhi, who developed the non-violent approach of satyagraha, truth or soul force, waging a struggle and searching for an alternative, a deeper harmony beneath the conflict. Somebody gave out a little image just before I began my talk. I'd like you to just look at that for a minute. It helps me have a better understanding of what truth, force, and non-violence are about. It was produced by the Welsh artist John Petts, and it was his act of solidarity, his reaching out to a community in Alabama, where in 1963 a church was firebombed and little girls were murdered. And he created for them this beautiful stained glass window. What do we see? We see a black Christ. That would have had special meaning in Alabama in 1963. A black Christ. We see a rainbow, a sign of the unity and the reconciliation and the hope of a mixed community in the future. The rainbow of hope for the future. We see the words from Matthew's gospel. And we see Christ's hands set out in this formation. One hand reaching out, saying clearly, stop. Stop the violence, the oppression, the injustice, the suffering, wherever it is, whatever place and time, we have to challenge it. But the other is telling us about how we need to challenge. With the other, we are open. We are saying, but we need to involve you, our enemy, our friends, those who disagree with us. We need to work together if we are to achieve the kind of transformation, the deep healing that we're seeking in our world today. Remembering war, making peace. Yes, the struggle does go on. And through our baptism, and as those blessed peacemakers named in the Beatitudes, we're all invited to be at the heart of this struggle. Thank you.
Thank you so much. An amazing spread of words on war from 1918 to 2018 and encompassing all that conflict that has happened in the last 100 years. But I thank you very much for reminding us of the hopeful signs, the signs that go on and that perhaps some of us just don't realise are happening. So it's great to see that there are genuine peacemakers around in the world at the moment. And thank you for, at this particular point, as we come towards Remembrance Sunday, reminding us of to be inclusive in our remembrance. And certainly when I went to the battlefield sites, the German war graves and the British ones and the Australian ones and all the Polish ones, there were so many people lost over the last two major conflicts. And it's really important to remember each one of those was somebody's son or, sadly, daughter. Taking us through this 100 years has been perfect introduction, really, to the next two talks, which lead me on to a little bit of conflict we've had here. minor conflict, of course. We've been really blessed with the speakers for this series, but it hasn't been without a bit of juggling. As a result, next week, sadly, we can't have Canon Sarah from Coventry Cathedral. She's not able to come, and she's not able to come at all. So somebody from the community of Cross of Nails at Coventry, Alice Farnhill, has generously offered to come, but she can't come next week. She can come on the 14th. I didn't want to ask Mike Wooldridge to come on any other day because he'd agreed to come on the 7th, and that's fantastic. So we'll have a week off, if you don't mind, next week, and then reconvene on the 7th of November to hear Mike Wooldridge offer what I think actually will be a perfectly wonderfully timed talk following on from yours, Pat. His title is "We Cannot Say We Didn't Know, Reporting War and Peace." Now, obviously, Mike Wooldridge is not 100 years old, so his reporting career has been over the last 40 years or 45 years. We really look forward to welcoming him. And then on the 14th, so an extra date to tag on to the end, we will welcome Alice Farnhill. And I've had quite an email exchange with her, and I'm really thrilled that she's agreed to come. She's so enthusiastic. She says that the 14th of November is a very significant day for them at Coventry Cathedral, and she's entitled her talk, "Destruction, Hope and Renewal, From the Bombing of Coventry Cathedral to the Community of the Cross of Nails." And I think there can't be a better place to end this series than with that title. So I hope that you'll all be able to take a week off next week and come back again in a fortnight's time and be around for those two talks when we welcome those two wonderful speakers. Now, William has given me a little flyer. If you enjoyed last week's talk from Christopher Seaman, I certainly did, on the music that had come out of the First World War, the Elgar Society have got an afternoon talk at St. Lawrence Parish Room in Colebrook Street on Saturday the 3rd of November, entitled "The Spirit of England." You're there, William. William's there. He's got some flyers. So if you were interested in that, or you know somebody who would like to go, then you'd be very welcome to join the Elgar Society for that. There are sandwiches downstairs, as always, and tea and coffee and scones and people with plates for your donations at both the doors. It's lovely to see you and look forward to seeing you in a fortnight. Thank you. Bye-bye.